From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the nominations for the Writers Guild Awards are out, and we'll hear from several of the nominees. Then, celebrity photographer Mark Seliger has had some strange ideas for his photo shoots, sometimes involving live pigeons or baby doll heads, but he has a strategy for getting his way.
Somebody's going to get nervous about it. If it's not the publicist, it might be the artist. So I always lean towards not giving it up too quickly.
And Eugene Jarecki has a Grammy nomination for his documentary, The King, which argues that Elvis is a metaphor for America. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott, for consideration in all categories.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Fox Searchlight, presenting The Favorite, nominated for 3 Screen Actors Guild Awards for Best Actress Olivia Colman and Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, awards eligible in all categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The nominations for the Writers Guild of America Awards were announced today. And unlike that absurd ceremony last night, these awards often mirror the Academy Award nominations. The Oscar nominations will be announced on January 22nd. Just like the Academy, the WGA has 2 categories, one for original screenplays and one for adapted works. And a lot of these movies are also considered frontrunners for the Academy Award for Best Picture. We've had several of the WGA nominees on The Frame, and we'll bring you some excerpts today. The shortlist for adapted screenplay is Black Panther, Can You Ever Forgive Me?, A Star is Born, If Beale Street Could Talk, and Black Klansman. Earlier today, I spoke with Spike Lee about Black Klansman, which is based on the memoir by Ron Stallworth, a black policeman in Colorado who infiltrated the KKK in the late 1970s.
This is David Duke.
Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. That David Duke?
Last time I checked. What can I do for you?
Well, since you asked, I hate blacks. I hate Jews, Mexicans, and Irish. And anyone else, really, that doesn't have pure white Aryan blood running through their veins.
I'm happy to be talking to a true white American.
God bless white America.
I asked Lee about the tone of the script that he co-wrote with Kevin Willmott, among other writers, and Lee started with how producer Jordan Peele pitched him on the film's premise.
When Jordan Peele gave me the pitch of the film, the 6-word pitch, Black Man Infiltrates KKK. The first word that came to my mind is this true? And then Jordan said yes. And then the next word, this is absurd. So the humor, this is not a comedy. The humor from Black Klansman comes from the absurdity of the premise. Kevin and I weren't writing jokes. We were getting the humor organically from the premise.
Barry Jenkins, who 2 years ago won the Best Picture Oscar for Moonlight, adapted the James Baldwin novella If Beale Street Could Talk into a movie of the same name. It's the first Baldwin book turned into an American feature film. Jenkins said he was attracted by many elements of the Baldwin story, especially the young couple at its center.
Yeah, you know, how much the young lovers meant to each other was the first thing that grabbed me. It jumps off the page in a certain way, and especially in this novel, because, you know, Mr. Baldwin wrote with 2 very distinct voices. He wrote with many voices, but there were 2 that always jumped out to me the most. One was just almost enraptured with this idea of sensuality, with love, with romance, with passion. The other one was just as searing about depicting societal injustices, in particular the way that the lives and souls of black folks has been treated, you know, by the country that we all call home. And so when I read the book for the first time and saw just how devoted Tish and Fonny are to one another, I was just, I don't know, how can you not be lifted up by that?
In the original screenplay race, the nominees are 8th Grade, Green Book, A Quiet Place, Roma, and Vice. The latter film, about Vice President Dick Cheney, was written and directed by Adam McKay, who also made The Big Short. McKay talked about how his cast was part of the movie-making process, including Christian Bale, who plays Cheney.
Throughout the whole process, I was not only checking in with the actors about their research and what they were finding and letting it influence my directing, but I was also open to the idea of sometimes playing scenes differently, sometimes changing lines. And I think the final culmination of this came to a head where we were towards the last fifth of shooting the movie, and Bale came to me and said, you know, there's no moment where Dick Cheney ever looks at the camera. And I was like, yeah, I didn't really want him to. And he said, well, what if we just gave him one? What if we tried one? So my whole background is in improvisation. So, of course, I just say yes immediately. I was like, why not?
I will not apologize for keeping your family safe. And I will not apologize for doing what needed to be done so that your loved ones can sleep peaceably at night.
And for people who missed the film when it came out last summer, one of the WGA original screenplay nominees was for Eighth Grade. The movie about a young girl's adolescent struggles was written and directed by comedian and social media celebrity Bo Burnham. He based part of the story on his own online experiences.
My initial instinct was, okay, I have to write some big tandem narrative with 12 intersecting characters to get all these big ideas out. And then I stumbled on this voice and I was like, I mean, I could say everything I want and more through her. That the sort of peripheral problems I have with the internet that exist around the core of my life, which is I have a job and I have to pay taxes. For a kid, it's everything.
Hey guys, Kayla back here with another video. Okay, so the topic of today's video is putting yourself out there. Okay, so like, what does that mean? Where is there?
I've always been interested in the YouTube videos that no one's watching. I've always been interested in people on the internet that are expressing themselves and no one's paying attention to, because the sort of narrative of the internet, we only ever talk about the people that go viral and the people that get paid attention to, but a majority of the internet are people calling out into a void and getting no answer.
And Alfonso Cuarón wrote and directed Roma based on his own childhood in Mexico City and the caregivers who looked after him and his siblings. Cuarón said that writing and directing the film was difficult, in large part because he was analyzing his own life and what he did and didn't know about the people closest to him.
If you are thinking about your mom and remembering your mom, you don't really see her as a woman. You're not thinking about, say, her sexual life. You don't want to think about those things. You don't want to think too much about if she was lonely. You know, because we don't want to think that aspect of our dear ones. And you just start seeing more dimensions. You know, no matter how much you try to dig into someone else, you will never have the full picture.
That was Alfonso Cuarón. He has a Writers Guild Award nomination for his original screenplay for Roma. And by the way, Cuarón shot that film himself, and today he also got an award nomination from the American Society of Cinematographers. Coming up, photographer Mark Seliger tells stories about taking portraits of the most famous faces in pop culture.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott. AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, and Owen Gleiberman of Variety calls it an emotional knockout. Nominated for 4 SAG Awards, including Outstanding Performance by a Cast, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Supporting Actor, for consideration in all categories, including Best Picture and Best Director. KPCC podcasts are supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, nominated for a leading 14 Critics' Choice Awards, including Lead Actress Olivia Colman, Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, Acting Ensemble, Original Screenplay, Editing, Production Design, Costume Design, Cinematography, Director Yorgos Lanthimos, and Best Picture of the Year. Awards eligible in all categories.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Name almost any modern famous person, and there's a very good chance that Mark Seliger has taken his or her picture. The Dalai Lama, Barack Obama, Snoop Dogg, Amy Schumer, Misty Copeland, Mick Jagger, Kurt Cobain, Seliger has shot them all. Often for magazines like Rolling Stone, where Seliger was the chief photographer for 10 years, or for Vanity Fair or GQ. And while he's probably best known for his celebrity portraits, he's also worked in photojournalism, capturing images of 9/11 first responders and transgender people in New York City. His latest book, Mark Seliger Photographs, includes a wide range of his portraits from his more than 30 years behind the camera, and many of those images can now be seen in an exhibition at Fahey Klein Gallery in Los Angeles. I spoke with Seliger last year about his work and his process, and I asked him about the difference between photographing someone as an editorial assignment versus photojournalism.
Well, it's a very different approach, and wearing that hat of a journalist is complicated because, you know, you don't really inject a lot of your ideas into it. It's really like these kind of found, caught moments. And, you know, making a picture and taking a picture can be two different ways of thinking about it. So the first responder picture was an interesting assignment. I was working for Rolling Stone at the time, and they gave me kind of a short list of ideas they wanted to focus on. But a really good buddy of mine who worked for the Times got me into Ground Zero the very last day. And as we were scouting the area and basically getting pushed out by the police as they were closing the site, you know, it was a crime scene, so they were closing the site to firemen and to anybody else that was there. I saw these two firemen walking out, a captain and, you know, just another fireman walking out, and they just looked like, you know, there was this incredible melancholy about them, and they were covered in soot. And as I was walking, I kind of walked kind of in front of them, and they saw the camera, and they just kind of stood there and looked at me for a second, and I shot a couple of pictures. I had a little point-and-shoot. And then I just asked them if I could just take a couple more, and they, you know, just kind of looked at me and said, okay. And, you know, it was as if they were, you know, they were kind of in this dream. And then they closed the site, and that was the last that, you know, the firehouses could go in there and find their company.
We live in an era where not only celebrities and personalities are very concerned about their image, but they are surrounded by people, publicists, managers, who want to make sure that they don't do something that is contrary to the image that they're trying to cultivate. So what is it like when you're in a session with somebody and either that person or that person's people think that there are things that they should and should not do? And how do you get them to do something that you think they should do, even if they're reluctant?
Well, that you just hit the nail on the head when it comes to the strategy. If it's somebody that I really think that they are going to be, you know, a partner in crime and make a great photograph, really have this experience, then I would bring it up on the phone, usually a conversation before we get too far into it. However, I would say 75% of the time when I'm working on a concept, I'll sort of do it. I'll put it together. It'll be ready by the time they get there. And then, you know, usually a sort of a pre-shoot meeting, go over concepts. And sometimes the publicist will step in and go like, you're not doing that. And then they'll go, well, yes, I am. Or they'll give it some thought and they'll say, I don't think this is quite right. And then 9 out of 10 times they kind of come back and we figure out how to make it work for everybody. But, you know, the rule is you don't give up too much because somebody's going to get, you know, nervous about it. If it's not the publicist, it might be the artist. So I always lean towards not giving it up too quickly, you know, without it being like a total surprise of, you know, here are the flippers and the baby seal, you know. I feel like you gotta just kind of ease into it. And, you know, I have a good track record after doing this enough times to where I think people can kind of get excited that, wow, he put his energy into this and he really cares about this. And I remember one of the first experiences with Rolling Stone where I had the opportunity to do that, to play that, was with Fleetwood Mac. And I was supposed to call Mick Fleetwood at a recording studio. I was in New York, and I, you know, picked up the phone and I said, hey, I got this idea, Mick, about this picture with you and John McVie. And he was like, oh, really? What is it? And I said, well, I want to do, you know, celebrate your 25 years, Rolling Stone's 25 years, and kind of push it together and do a great wedding photograph of you and John. And there was dead silence. Oh, Christ.
And he goes, all right, Mark, I just have one special request. And I was going, well, what's that? And he goes, I want to be the bride.
Yep.
And that, to me, that was the biggest help in terms of the way that I, you know, encourage that process. It's like if you give somebody something that they really feel they can visualize and see and play with, it's fun for them.
I want to ask you about another picture. It's of Curtis Mayfield. He's in a bed. You're shooting kind of above him as if you're almost kind of a human drone looking down on him in his bed. Could you talk about how that picture came together, how you staged it the way you staged it, or how much of that was actually where Curtis was in his life at that point?
Well, that's how we met him the day before the shoot. We you know, typically the way that I will work is try to, you know, have a meeting before if I can, if we're in a town and we're sussing out a location. And so obviously Curtis was at home and we went by to look at the location and make some decisions. And, you know, the only movement he had was in a little bit in his hands and a little bit in his head, his neck. So that's how we saw him in his room. This is where he spent most of his time. And I was quietly getting to know him and talking to him, and he was just the sweetest soul. And I said, hey, I have this idea about photographing you from above because I just love this environment. And I said, would that be okay with you? And he goes, absolutely. He goes, this is a pretty honest way that I spend my day. So after talking to him for a few more minutes, we ran out and my assistant and I picked up some scaffolding at a, you know, a little hardware rental place. And the next day because I wanted it to be very safe, obviously. So we built the scaffolding straight overhead the bed, and I was able to do that picture that way. And, you know, the irony of it all was that a lighting scaffold, I believe, had fallen on him, you know, which would cause the paralysis at a show he had been doing. So I didn't really think about that, obviously, till after it was done, but I felt like that bird's eye view of the way that he was living his life was a really important documentation of my experience with him. And it was cathartic because, you know, here was this man that really had nothing left but, you know, the slight movement in his hand. And yet he was just joyful and positive and making music and, you know, very happy that we were there and happy to do anything we needed to and just really treated us lovely.
Let me ask you this last question. If part of your approach to taking photos is better to ask forgiveness than permission, I'm wondering if there was a subject of a photo who was like, no, 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 no. And you said, just try it, just try it. And he or she came back to you and said, you know what? You were right.
Oh, wow. I would say, you know, I don't know if it went exactly like that, but I remember when we're photographing Jerry Seinfeld for a double cover, which was the young and the old Elvis. And he kept calling me. I was in Los Angeles getting ready for the shoot. And he called me a couple times and said, hey, Mark, it's Jerry. And I was like, hey, Jerry, what's up? And he says, yeah, I just wanted to know what you got planned tomorrow. And I was like, oh, gosh, you know, we're still working out the details. And I got another call and he said, any ideas yet? And I said, yeah, it's going to be fine. You're going to love it. It's super simple. And he walked in the studio the next day and there were Elvis jumpsuits and wigs and sideburns all over the studio. And he was like, I don't know if I'm going to be doing an Elvis picture today. And we sat down and I explained to him that it was engineered this incredible idea once we came up with Elvis of a double cover, like a stamp. It was like the young and the old Elvis. And so the young Elvis was obviously like 50 million fans can't be wrong. And then the second cover was a jumpsuit, white jumpsuit with a chicken wing in his hand and a big, you know, a big popped out jaw of chicken meat. And it was just really funny. And Jerry really helped us to get to that point. But there was some resistance. And, you know, that happens all the time. There's always a second photo as a backup, which is a much more reductive, stripped-down photograph if you need to. So if I have a big idea, I'm pretty much prepared to have the alternative ready, the B-side ready, just in case.
That was photographer Mark Seliger. You can check out the exhibition Mark Seliger Photographs at Fahey Klein Gallery in Los Angeles through January 19th. Coming up, the Grammy Awards have a category for Best Music Film, and one of the nominees is a documentary about Elvis Presley.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change, because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Eugene Jarecki's documentary, The King, is about Elvis Presley, but it's hardly a straightforward music biography. Instead, it's more of a crazy cinematic quilt, intercutting archival footage with modern-day interviews, many of which were conducted with musicians in the backseat of Elvis's Rolls Royce, while the filmmakers drove cross-country, like this one with John Hiatt.
Rock and roll just meant the world to so many of us, you know. Our narrative as a country is one of bloodshed and violence and stolen land and slavery. And I think the music carried us into a time of revolutionary changes.
The documentary was released last year, but now it has a Grammy nomination for Best Music Film. Jarecki joined me in studio to make his case that Elvis Presley's life mirrors America itself.
So there's the obvious and the not so obvious. The obvious is, what could be more American than Elvis Presley? Who better represents the American dream? Here you have a country boy from the Mississippi Delta, the poorest of the poor, who, because of his own talent and his own persistence and vision and ambition and all those good things, rises to become what? The king. What more could fulfill the American dream than that? But then comes the less obvious part, because who is he? He's a white man. And the American dream, as we know, is available to white men. And not even all of them, only an elite few of them. So as Elvis grows up, we watch Elvis and America work in parallel. They both rise like a meteor. They both end up with power for which they're not prepared. They both struggle with the undertow of that power. And so they start reaching out for all kinds of quick fixes to deal with these fractures of the soul. They reach out for a quick medication, whether it's carbohydrates or alcohol or drugs or vanity or violence or consumption writ large. So we watch them in parallel, and it's amazing how many moments in his life mirror our own as a nation. And then the question is, where did he end up and where are we headed?
Well, Ethan Hawke, who is in the film and also one of the film's producers, says at one point in the film, at every critical juncture in his career, Elvis had a choice, and he always chose money. And that money wasn't necessarily the best thing for his music, for his audience, for his life. And yet at every key part, Elvis was governed more by dollars than cents, S-E-N-S-E.
I think when Ethan says that, he is speaking about the sacrifices that an artist makes to stay true to who they are and to not get wildly out of touch. And I think in Elvis's case, is that this is not something we blame Elvis for. We are all Elvis. We are all seducible by that in our society, which dangles convenience or dangles riches. Or who among us, if faced with the incredible outpouring of love and support and power that was made available to Elvis, who among us would have the better sense to say, on second thought, I'm going to go back to Memphis, back to my roots? A lot of us don't do that. And as we look ahead into how this world has to be made better, we ourselves have to make ourselves less seducible by power, by money, and by other things that are quick fixes.
I want to talk a little bit about cultural appropriation of black music by Elvis in the movie.
Elvis was a hero to most. Elvis was a hero to most, but he never meant to me. Yes, he's straight out racist. The sucker was simple and plain.
In the song Fight the Power, when I talked about Elvis was a hero the most, it was absolute truth. He was called the king of rock and roll, which I took offense to, because he wasn't no more of a king than Little Richard.
Chuck D's interview in my film is one of the best interviews I've ever been a part of. What he does in the film is he says, listen, I didn't accuse Elvis of being a racist when I wrote Fight the Power, because he stole black music. I think people should steal each other's music, and it's not stealing, it's culture. Well, thank God someone like Elvis, a white kid in the 50s, felt courageous enough to let black music radiate through him such that church groups and conservative groups and others were burning his records and to saying he was the Antichrist for unleashing blackness into American homes. Elvis is to be commended for that. What's not to be commended is the same way that industry in America steals from black people in every industry. We've started stealing from black people when we stole them from Africa. Then once we got them here, we stole their labor. Then once we were done with that, we've been stealing all the way along, and the music business was no different. It stole the music of black people by promoting the likes of Elvis Presley, who gets to be the king. What about Chuck Berry? What about Bo Diddley? What about B.B. King?
There was a time when I was growing up when you turn on a movie and you'll get an Elvis movie. You turn on the radio, you get an Elvis song. So it was just like he was the right person to sell and market to a white country.
Later on, when black America needed people like Marlon Brando, needed people like Jane Fonda, needed people like Muhammad Ali to stand up.
During the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War.
To stand up for all that, Elvis, in his own words, takes the view, I don't really think that's an entertainer's job. And one can condemn him for that. As Chuck D says at one point in my interview with him, it's sort of, he's kind of nodding along in the radiation of a racist society. It's a beautiful way Chuck puts it. But really what's to be said then is, where are you when the black community then needs you, this community that you've already demonstrated you love?
One of the very last scenes in the film is of Elvis performing before he dies. It is both beautiful and terrifying because he does not look well, and yet it's an incredible performance. Can you talk a little bit about that performance, why it's important, and why you ended the film with it?
When I first saw that performance where Elvis sings the Righteous Brothers' Unchained Melody, and it's days before he will die, his passion and his skill are overwhelming. His body is almost unrecognizable. He's bloated, he's sweating, he's under the influence, and he sits down at that piano. The voice of an angel would be a cliche. It's the voice of 1,000 angels. And the voice of 1,000 demons comes screaming out of him with all of the lostness and the compromised authenticity that he's experiencing.
And he's 42.
And he's 42 years old. It's so powerful for me, and it's the beauty of him and the beauty of ourselves in that second.
That was filmmaker Eugene Jarecki. His documentary, The King, has a Grammy nomination for Best Music Film. The other nominees are Life in 12 Bars, about Eric Clapton, Whitney, about Whitney Houston, Quincy, about Quincy Jones, and Itzhak, about Itzhak Perlman. And that's all we have for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow. But when I hold you in my